You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
This episode of the Majority Report is sponsored by Igloo. Igloo is an intranet you're actually going to like. It's a cloud platform that can help you do your best work. You can share files, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage projects with your coworkers. Sign up now and try it for free at igloosoftware.com/majority. That's igloosoftware.com/majority.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, January 27th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown, snowy, blizzardy, downtown Brooklyn. That's right, folks. This is a pre-tape. As we speak, it is actually Monday. I know this is going to blow your mind, but we can actually travel through time and space via recording devices. It is snowing, but there's significant snowfall as I record. And already, school's been canceled for Tuesday. We are expecting gusts up to 50 miles an hour. We're talking about at least 18 to 24 inches of snow. Could be more. You're going to see snow drifts that can get up to like 5, 6, 7, 8 feet with that type of wind and this type of snow. Right now, as we speak, or as I speak, no, let me rephrase that. Right now, as you hear me speak, I am sitting at home with two kids who already have cabin fever. Mila is complaining that she doesn't have the proper boots to go outside. Nikki's saying, you can't take a two-year-old out. It's a blizzard. And I'm like, come on. This is what we did back in the 1800s or, I don't know, I guess maybe in the 1700s. Probably.
You're older than I thought.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, no. I've seen a lot of this weather stuff. So trust me when I tell you, the planet's warming. Wow. I've been around for a long time. Pre-industrial age.
Sam Steeder.
That's right. However, that said, we all here at the Majority Report had the ability to listen to the radio or the TV and find out about a coming blizzard. So,
dude, I'm surprised that you didn't. I thought that was an obvious opening because the way you do it, it's always set up in the same way. I'm at home,
right.
Mila, the kids, loud, can't do anything, blah, blah, blah. Then it should be like Matt enjoying a Monster Energy drink, playing video games.
All right.
Michael practicing yoga before having a Chablis.
That's right.
Like what are you – like I was That's expecting right. that. I don't know what happened.
I forgot that you guys were actually I hope that you guys have tried to make it to the office, forgetting that it was
– He came to work after Sandy, like before almost anybody else in the city was going anywhere.
Oh, I didn't.
No.
Oh, I did. But you literally couldn't come.
I couldn't come.
Well, we have that same problem today. So, folks, however, we did a pre-record an interview for you with Erwin Chemerinsky. He is the dean of the UC Irvine Law School about his new book, The Case Against the Supreme Court. And enjoy this. And hopefully we will be back on tomorrow, Wednesday, with a live show. And before we go, let me just tell you this. Our sponsor today is Igloo. And Igloo is a software that basically creates an intranet for you. Now, let me make this clear. Matthew, Michael, if we were to institute something like this, it would allow you to do work. We could actually share and collaborate on documents. We could share files. We could share blog updates, coordinate calendars, manage projects. So in other words, I'd be putting this stuff up there, and you guys would have the capacity to access it even on your phone, even though you would probably do no work on it.
So let's say another platform for us to not do work on.
For you guys to not get the work done. This thing is easy to use, easy to configure, even for the most non-technical users. So Michael, Matt could get it. Michael would not be able to figure out how to set it up.
I wouldn't. But, and for Matt, it would be like looking for sound. It would take him a while, but he'd figure it out eventually.
Now, if you're a large company and you're stuck using SharePoint or a Fast, or, and I'm not exactly sure what SharePoint is because we're a smaller enterprise, but if you're a fast-growing business and you're overwhelmed by apps, you can create an intranet that you can actually brand to look like your company and to look like the stuff that you're working on. You can sign up now and try it for free at igloosoftware.com/majority. That's igloosoftware.com/majority. And Michael, just so that I'm clear with you, you would take that URL and type it into your browser. Because I know that that's
what's
confusing.
A browser?
Exactly.
Michael figures it out, types it in, and goes, I don't see any ice on this page.
igloosoftware.com/.
I think that actually is the worst joke I've ever heard in my life.
All right. We'll be right back with Erwin Chemerinsky. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, he is the dean of the UC Irvine School of Law, author of 8 books, and his latest includes The Case Against the Supreme Court. Professor, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Now, I have to say, I mean, I have a deep affinity for your book as a law school dropout and someone who was very much disillusioned by the Gore v. Bush ruling, which we will get to. It's fascinating to me that it's taken so long, it seems, for a broadside on the institution in and of itself. But before we get there, as you make a case against the Supreme Court, what is the Supreme Court supposed to do in your mind?
I believe the Supreme Court exists to enforce the Constitution. I think the Constitution exists especially to protect the rights of minorities. After all, majorities can usually do what they want through the political process. I think the Constitution also plays a special role in times of crisis. The framers knew that in times of crisis, there'd be a tendency to centralize power, a tendency towards repression. And so I think the court then plays a special role in protecting minorities, and that's minorities of all sorts, those who can't protect themselves through the political process, as well as making sure that the Constitution is followed in times of crisis.
And so it's interesting because you for decades have been teaching law and have been espousing, I guess, a perspective of the Supreme Court. Well, why don't you talk about your path to disillusionment with the court?
Sure. This is my 35th year as a law professor. I've been teaching and writing and litigating about constitutional law all this time. I've certainly been critical of many Supreme Court decisions during this time, but I also realized that I've been tending to make excuses for the Supreme Court. And I have a look at the court more critically, more candidly, I realize that it's so often failed, often in the most important times and important tasks in American history.
Give us a some examples of those failures.
Well, I start in Chapter 1 after the introductory chapter with the Supreme Court and race. From 1787, when the Constitution was written, until 1865, when the 13th Amendment was ratified, every Supreme Court decision ruled in favor of the rights of slave owners in the institution of slavery. Not once did the court do anything to protect the rights of slaves or chip away at slavery. From 1896 to 1954, a period of 58 years, the Supreme Court articulated and allowed separate but equal. This led to Jim Crow laws that segregated every aspect of Southern life in ways that were anything but separate but equal. And this continues. On June 25th, 2013, not quite 2 years ago, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional key provisions of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The first time since the 19th century that the Supreme Court has invalidated a federal civil rights law dealing with race.
Give us some other examples, because I'm curious as to sort of the spectrum. Or let me back up for a moment. What, and I don't want to get into the reforms yet. We have plenty of time to unpack this. But, I mean, when you talk about in terms of race, that the court was clearly sort of behind the curve, what, and in your mind, that it is necessarily failing because it's clearly not supporting the rights of, in this instance or at that time, a literal minority, in terms of a whole class of people's rights. I mean, what was it structurally that led to it reinforcing sort of the tyranny of the majority, which theoretically has an outlet through the political process?
I think some of it is that through much of the early 19th century, you had a Supreme Court that had a majority who were slave owners. The court that decided the infamous Dred Scott versus Sanford had a majority that had been or were slave owners. I think also what we have today is a quite politically conservative court that wants to believe that race discrimination is a thing of the past.
I mean, when we talk about the Roberts Court, I mean, is it conservative ideals that's driving it in the context of the Voting Rights Act? And we should just tell people that it the gutting was the Section 4, which called for states or specifically counties that have had a history of racial discrimination to be subject to preclearance by the Department of Justice. And of course, the court basically said, we don't like that formulation as to who is required to get preclearance. Congress needs to go back and work on it. And it was quite clear Congress had no interest or was not going to. But is that an ideological or like a partisan ruling?
Both. Congress, when it passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965, knew that it wasn't enough to prohibit race discrimination in voting and to authorize lawsuits to enforce that ban. Congress was aware that especially southern states were constantly changing their election systems to disadvantage minority voters. So Congress added what you just referred to as the preclearance requirement. For jurisdictions that have a history of race discrimination in voting, they could change their election systems only with permission of the Attorney General or three-judge federal district court. The preclearance requirement was tremendously successful in preventing race discrimination in voting. But the Supreme Court, 5-4, declared that unconstitutional. The majority was Roberts, Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito. Justice Ginsburg wrote the dissent, joined by Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. So it was political. It does help Republican candidates at the expense of Democratic candidates. But it's also ideological. Chief Justice Roberts, in his majority opinion, specifically said that race discrimination in voting, in his views, is largely a thing of the past, that it doesn't exist like it used to.
And you know what struck me about that, and I'd like your take on this, is I think at one point Scalia either, I think, wrote or articulated the notion that even though it had been reauthorized, the Voting Rights Act, I think it was in 2007 or 2006, by a vast majority of both Republican and Democrat lawmakers in both houses, that he was divining that it was too sensitive of an issue for them to vote upon, and they couldn't really vote what they really thought was that it shouldn't be reauthorized. Have I been fair in that assessment of what Scalia?
Exactly. First,
that's shocking to me.
Yeah, the law passed almost unanimously. The extension of these provisions, Voting Rights Act, passed the Senate 98-0. There were only 33 no votes in the House of Representatives. President George W. Bush signed it into law. Second, at the oral argument, Justice Scalia dismissed the significance of that. He said it becomes, quote, and these are his words, a racial entitlement, and it's impossible to take away racial entitlements.
I mean, isn't that contrary to every notion? I mean, the idea that you are explicitly reversing a political decision, but you're doing so because you just perceive that that politics makes it uncomfortable for them to vote the way that they really should. I mean, that just seems just bizarre to me.
I agree. The very next day, June 26, 2013, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act. Justice Scalia wrote a vehement dissent in which he said the Defense of Marriage Act passed almost unanimously through Congress, was signed by the president, the court had to defer to the popular will. It's so interesting that the day before, in striking down provisions of the Voting Rights Act, Justice Scalia gave no weight to the vote in Congress or the popular will.
All right. Well, let's tell us a little bit about the Warren Court. This was a court that Chief Justice Warren obviously presided from 1953 to 1969. Give us your perspective on that period of the court and why that is slightly different, but still does not sway you from the need for the institution to have reform.
There is much for all of us, liberal and conservative, to applaud about the Warren Court. It was the Warren Court that ended the Jim Crow laws that segregated all aspects of Southern life. In Brown versus Board of Education, the court famously said, separate can never be equal in the realm of public education. That paved the way for the end of all of the Jim Crow laws. It was the Warren Court that applied the Bill of Rights to the states. Most provisions of the Bill of Rights had never been applied to the states. So in Gideon versus Wainwright, it was the Supreme Court that said in 1963, that anyone who's being tried for a crime in state court where there's a possible prison sentence has the right to a lawyer. The Warren Court tremendously expanded the rights of criminal defendants, an unpopular group that never gets protection through the political process. The Warren Court greatly expanded the protection of voting rights and ensured equal voting through the country. And yet, in many ways, the Warren Court didn't do nearly as much as it could have or should have. Let me pick two examples. One is Brown versus Board of Education. Today, public schools are increasingly separate and unequal. And I think the court, starting with the Warren Court, deserves a great deal of blame for that. I mentioned Gideon versus Wainwright, a very famous case, widely applauded. And yet all over the country today, people are being tried for crimes, including capital crimes, with grossly deficient lawyers.
Let's also turn to the question of, I mean, because you've cited a lot of cases that have to do with civil rights and civil liberties. And I know that your critique of the Roberts Court includes the dynamic of minority interests in the form of a power dynamic in terms of individuals versus corporations. But give us a sense of what the court historically has treated those type of, I guess, business interests over consumer or worker interests.
Throughout history, the Supreme Court has been far more likely to side with corporations and corporate power than it has been to rule in favor of individuals like employees and consumers. I talked in some detail about a period of constitutional history from the mid-1890s through 1936, where the court declared unconstitutional 200 laws that were designed to protect workers and consumers. As an example, the first federal statute to limit the use of child labor was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. In the modern era, under the Roberts Court, again, it's much more likely to rule in favor of corporate power than to rule in favor of individuals like employees and consumers.
I mean, give us a sense of what the reasoning is was at that time as to why child labor laws should be considered unconstitutional.
We've got to understand that this was a court that was very strongly pro-business and very much against government regulation of business. Congress passed a law that prohibited the shipment in interstate commerce of goods made by children. It prohibited children under 14 from being used in manufacturing goods. Children over 14 couldn't work more than 10 hours a day or 60 hours a week. So we're not talking about a law that was particularly draconian. It's a law that we'd all agree today is absolutely essential. But the Supreme Court said that it was unconstitutional because it violated states' rights. The court said it's up to states to decide whether to prohibit child labor. Of course, the problem with that is that the market would really prevent states from being able to do so. A state that prohibited child labor would be a competitive disadvantage in the market compared to the states that allowed child labor. Child labor was cheaper than adult labor. It led to cheaper goods and services. Inevitably, that would be a pressure to the bottom. That's why we needed national legislation. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. So many children were maimed and died as a result.
And so, I mean, how does something like that ultimately turn? It's really just a function of who the personnel on the court is, right?
And political and economic pressure. By the mid-1930s, the pressure on the court to change was great. If ever one could believe in an unregulated economy, the Depression clearly made that impossible. Also, after winning a landslide re-election in 1936, President Franklin Roosevelt threatened to change the size of the Supreme Court to get a majority that upholds his policies. All of this, and then the retirement of the conservative justices, let Roosevelt get his majority, and the court shifted course.
And so let's move up to the Roberts Court. I mean, let's start first where you in your book you express a lot of frustration, and I remember it contemporaneously, particularly with Roberts, this notion that a judge is supposed to just call balls and strikes, I think is what Roberts said, but also the notion that a judge does.
I think John Roberts should be ashamed of himself for saying in his confirmation hearings that judges are just like umpires, they call balls and strikes. That's trying to make it seem that the justices' views don't matter when the case is decided. We all know better than that. The Constitution is written in very broad language. No cruel and unusual punishment. No denial of equal protection. What does that mean? Also, the rights in the Constitution are not absolute. The court has to balance them against other considerations. How that balancing is done is entirely a function of who are the justices and what are their views.
So let's talk about the Roberts Court. I mean, you critique the court in three areas, at least that comes to mind: regulation of business, the ability to sue the government, cases affecting the political process generally. Let's start with the regulation of business. In what ways do they inhibit the ability of business to be regulated?
This is the most pro-business Supreme Court that there's been since the mid-1930s. A study was done by Richard Posner, a judge on the Seventh Circuit, William Landis, professor of economics at the University of Chicago, and Lee Epstein, now a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. And they came up with a number of measures, and by all of them, this is the most pro-business court there's been since the mid-1930s. So what does this mean? Well, as an example, people who are injured after taking generic drugs cannot sue. That you can sue the maker of a brand name drug, but the maker of a generic drug can't be sued, not for failure to warn consumers, not for a design defect. As another example, this is a court that has very aggressively enforced arbitration clauses, even when they really are contracts of adhesion, and they're unfairly and without any bargaining imposed on people.
I mean, explain that dynamic to people, because I mean, I think I'm particularly sensitive to it because I'm a big fan of trial lawyers, and this is effectively shutting people out of an ability to get any type of redress. Will you just expand on what that means? The difference between a contract.
I went to a new eye doctor for the first time not too long ago, and the receptionist gave me a big stack of papers to fill out. In the middle was a form that I was asked to sign that if I had any claims against the doctor arising out of the treatment, I couldn't sue the doctor in court. I'd have to go to arbitration. I asked the receptionist if the doctor would still see me if I didn't sign the form. She said she didn't know. Nobody ever asked her the question before. I've now heard from many people of doctors who will not see patients unless they sign arbitration agreements. When my second son turned 26, he could no longer be covered by my health insurance. I went to sign him up for a relatively inexpensive policy. In order to sign up, it is required that you click the box that if you have any disputes, you'll go to arbitration, you won't go to court. If anyone is listening has ever tried to use a new iPad or computer, in order to use it for the first time, you have to click to agree, you agree to the terms. One of the terms is always an arbitration agreement. Business favors arbitration. It keeps cases out of court. It keeps them from juries. Business also knows that arbiters who want to continue to hear cases will, more often than not, rule in favor of the business interests. You don't really have a neutral judge. And yet the Supreme Court has very aggressively said that arbitration clauses are to be enforced.
And what do you say to someone who says, well, then you don't have to go see that doctor, you don't have to use that computer software, or you don't have to get that health insurance?
In the law, there's a phrase, contracts of adhesion. It's where you really have no choice at all. Let's take, for example, a tablet. If every company that puts out tablets, like the iPad, require that you agree to arbitration, you really don't have a choice. If doctors are forced by insurance companies to insist on arbitration, there's really no choice.
And then, of course, I mean, it, I guess, particularly in the case of the doctor, it imposes a lot of burden on you to find that doctor. It may not be one that is convenient or is even accessible to you. So let's also talk about the ability to sue government for constitutional violations.
I think one of the most important things that the Roberts Court, and for that matter, its predecessors, the Rehnquist and the Berger Courts, have done, is to close the courthouse doors to those who are injured. Specifically those who were injured by government officers. The court has said there's a whole category of government officers that even if they act wrongly can't be sued for money damages. One thing that might shock your listeners is that if a police officer intentionally commits perjury on the witness stand, the police officer can't be sued for money damages. Wow. The police officer could be criminally prosecuted for perjury. The police officer could be administratively disciplined. But a police officer who commits perjury can't be sued for money damages.
I mean, what is the legal argument about that?
The Supreme Court has said we want to preserve the discretion of police officers. We don't want them to be chilled by fear of liability. Judges, no matter what they do, can't be sued for money damages. There's one very famous case where a woman went to see a judge in his chambers in Indiana. And the woman said, you know, I'm worried about my daughter. She's staying out at night. I want to have her surgically sterilized. The judge gave an order for a tubal ligation to be performed. The girl was told she was having an appendectomy. Only many years later, when she tried to conceive a child and couldn't, did she learn what had been done to her.
Oh, jeez.
She sued the judge. After all, no case had been filed in the judge's court. No notice had been given to her. The judge had no legal authority to order her surgical sterilization. And yet the Supreme Court said the judge couldn't be sued for money damages. There's another case I talk about in the book where a witness didn't show up. The judge said to the bailiff, go find him and beat him up. Show him he can't not show up in my courtroom. The bailiff went and seriously injured the person. The victim sues the judge and says, ordering people to be beaten up isn't part of being a judge. The Supreme Court said the judge couldn't be sued for money damages. A prosecutor who knowingly uses perjured testimony can't be sued for money damages.
Wow. And so let's also talk about, I mean, this is the this week marks the fifth anniversary of Citizens United. The Roberts Court has been pretty relentless in its, I guess, siding with moneyed interests against anyone who would attempt to reform the implications of money in our elections.
The Supreme Court is very hostile to campaign finance regulation. I think that when we look back at the Roberts Court, one of its worst, if not its worst decision, was Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, decided on January 21st, 2010, where the court held that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money from their corporate treasuries in election campaigns.
And I mean, one of the things that I found shocking about that decision, which I think, you know, it still resonates. I think it was Kennedy who said that there was no, I guess, even there was going to be plenty of transparency. The idea of even there being a perception that a campaign or a politician we bought is beyond the pale. And then shortly thereafter, you had examples like Sheldon Adelson and others spending millions to literally change the course of, at the very least, the Republican primary. I mean, is this something that could ever be revisited? I mean, what is – I mean, and I guess let's address the reforms. I mean, what is – there are some people who have advocated – we should just get rid of the Supreme Court, or at the very least, it would be within constitutional bounds to make the court largely powerless, except in very narrow circumstances. That's not the the prescription that you espouse. Let's start with why not, and then with what you do.
Let me start with Citizens United. It can be changed by a future Supreme Court. It could be overridden by a constitutional amendment, though that's, of course, not likely to happen. There could be laws to limit the effects of Citizens United, like disclosure laws, but we haven't seen them. In terms of the question about the court for the future, there are those who argue that we should eliminate the power of courts to declare laws unconstitutional. There's some prominent scholars, like Mark Tustin of Harvard University, or Larry Kramer, the former dean of Stanford Law School, who said that. But I think it's fundamentally misguided. I think Marbury versus Madison got it right. The limits of the Constitution have meaning only if they're enforced. When I think of the people who I've represented over my career as a lawyer, individuals on death row, criminal defendants, a homeless man before the United States Supreme Court, prisoners, I realize for my clients, the courts are nothing. When's the last time that a state legislature adopted a law to expand the rights of criminal defendants? When's the last time a state legislature adopted a law to increase the protections for prisoners? So even if the court often fails, I believe that the court is essential in order to enforce the Constitution.
All right. So what are the reforms that, from your perspective, are necessary to get the Supreme Court to fulfill the function that you argue it should, which is to protect the rights of minorities in a broad sense, or I guess those who have less power to make sure that their constitutional rights are being protected?
In the book, I propose many reforms. I'd start with having the court for the first time acknowledge, and a society acknowledge, that the court's preeminent role should be to enforce the Constitution, to protect minorities, to especially enforce the Constitution in times of crisis. I argue for changing the way we select Supreme Court justices, urging we go to a merit selection system. I argue for changing the confirmation process so it's no longer, in the words of former Senator Joe Biden, just an exercise in kabuki theater. I think that we should have term limits for Supreme Court justices. I favor 18-year non-renewable terms. Thankfully, life expectancy is a lot greater now than it used to be. Clarence Thomas was 43 years old when he was confirmed for the Supreme Court in 1991. If he remains on the court until he's 90 years old, the age at which Justice Stevens retired, he'll be a justice for 47 years. That's too much power exercised by one person for too long a period of time. I argue for changing the way the court communicates with the American people. As an example, there should be cameras in every Supreme Court proceeding. The ethical rules that apply to federal district court and federal court of appeals judges need to be applied to Supreme Court justices as well.
In terms of recusing yourself.
Exactly.
I want to just touch on two. One is the merit system. How would that work?
Well, a president could voluntarily do this. Jimmy Carter did it for federal district court and federal court of appeals judges. A president could create a merit selection panel. It could be bipartisan. And the president could say, I want you to send me at least two names for every vacancy. And I want it to be somebody that two-thirds of you can agree to, so it's truly bipartisan. And the president said, I'll either pick from that list or ask for other names. This has been done in many states, and it's worked very effectively.
And turning to term limits, why 18 years as opposed to, I don't know, 26 or 9?
There's 9 justices on the court. If there's 18-year non-renewable terms, then there'll be a vacancy every 2 years. No longer will this depend on the accident of history. Every president would get 2 vacancies to fill, absent unforeseen circumstances. Now, so much really does depend on accidents of history. Richard Nixon had 4 vacancies in 2 years to fill. Jimmy Carter got no vacancies in 4 years to fill.
Fascinating. And lastly, let me ask... You know, when as a dean of a law school, of someone who has been teaching law for 35 years now, I mean, when, you know, and it, to the extent that it appears, I mean, to those who would critique your book, that what you're doing is basically saying, like, I just don't like how the Supreme Court is ruling. And so I would like to impose these reforms that I think that will bring in, that will increase the chances of future rulings being ruled in the way that I think it should be. I mean, what is your response to something like that? And who is, what are you hoping comes out of writing this book, The Case Against the Supreme Court?
Well, my hope is that I'll better educate people about the court, that people realize that the court is made of human beings making value choices. I think the best way to avoid repeating the mistakes of the past is to be aware of them, and my hope is that this might lead to some of the reforms that I've proposed.
I mean, what is your response to those who say, well, you know, you just don't like the way the court is ruling, so you're not really asking for institutional reform, you're asking for a different political outcome?
I tried very hard to pick examples where both liberals and conservatives would say that the court made tragic mistakes. No one today, liberal or conservative, is going to defend the Supreme Court's decisions protecting the institution of slavery. No one, liberal or conservative today, is going to defend the court's separate but equal decisions. No one, liberal or conservative today, is going to defend the Supreme Court's case in Korematsu versus the United States that upheld the evacuation and internment of Japanese Americans. So I think I'm making a critique that both liberals and conservatives can agree to, and then my hope is that both liberals and conservatives can agree to the need for reforms.
Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of the School of Law of UC Irvine, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Genuinely
anytime.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Oh, folks, don't forget podcastawards.com. We need you to nominate the Majority Report for a Best in News and Politics nomination and People's Choice. Podcastawards.com. It'll take you 2 minutes. We just have a couple more days, and we're obviously not going to be able to push it as hard because of the snow.